Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You might actually be the most derivative one of all. I mean, Christ, the same house.
Maybe so. But you forgot the first rule of surviving a stab movie. Never answer the...
I'm bored.
Wait!
And welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking Keep Clean During Your Menstrual Cycle. We're talking Psycho homages. And we're talking, Paul, there's someone in the fucking room. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace. And we're talking what I believe to be the scariest and actually only scary entry in the Friday the 13th franchise.
Oh my.
Friday the 13th Part 2, everybody. Because what's Friday, Joe?
It's another Friday the 13th.
Yeah, there we go.
But the October version, like, how often does this ever happen?
Very rarely, right? And I'm really happy to be talking about this one, because we've done Jason X, we've done Part 7, and we've done Part 6.
No, I think we've done Part 4.
No, we have definitely not done Part 4.
God damn it. Technically, we have also done the original, but only as a Patreon minisode.
Oh, yeah. That was those early pandemic days when we were looking for content. I know that you are not big on this franchise, Joe. So I'm curious, before we get really into it, what are your overall thoughts on this film?
So I ended up really, really liking this on a rewatch. It was interesting because I had seen it before. I knew that. I couldn't remember the last time I had seen it, but it had been quite a while. And when I logged it on Letterboxd, my original score for this was a 3, which is ridiculously lowballed. And I ended up moving this up to a 4.5.
Oh, wow. That's even higher than the highest ranking I've given to a Friday film is a 4-star rating. But curious, is that on a Friday the 13th scale for you? Or like, is that like, no, this is a 4.5-star film for me?
It's more of a Friday scale, but it's also, I think, probably the most accomplished film in the franchise.
I would agree with that. But okay, we've gone too far. Let's bring in our guest who's waiting in the wings. Everyone, he is the host of The Evolution of Horror, a weekly podcast that explores the history of the horror genre by delving into particular subgenres across several weeks, discussing a particular film in depth to look at its place within a subgenre and its impact and legacy on cinema history. Please welcome the wonderful Mike Munzer.
Hello. Ooh, thank you so much for having me. Happy Friday the 13th.
Yes. I'm curious, Mike. So same question that I asked Joe. What is your relationship with this film? Like, when did you first see this movie?
I think Friday the 13th was one of those early franchises for me. I expect it is for so many of us, right? Horror fans of a certain age or generation. I think when I started falling in love with horror, I was around 13, 14 years old. And it was Scream, really, that kind of like sparked my love of the genre. And as I'm sure you guys know, so many people have that same thing where once you discover Scream, you subsequently discover all these other slasher movies because of the references in Scream, right? So I remember... seeing and falling in love with Scream and then being like, oh, what's this movie Halloween they're talking about? What's this Nightmare on Elm Street they're talking about? And of course, Friday the 13th. So I spent the next like year of my life just like devouring 80s slasher movies, it feels like. So, and Friday the 13th was very much part of that. I don't think I watched them in order. I think, you know, my local video store only had certain movies from the franchise. I think I actually came to part two later than I came to Jason Takes Manhattan, for example. So yeah, I sort of watched them all out of order, but generally I have a lot of fun with these movies. I think they're good for a certain type of horror viewing, aren't they? I love, you know, sitting with some friends, cracking open a beer, like watching something a little bit brainless and fun. It's not going to give me the visceral scares of something like the original Halloween, for example, but it's they're always a fun time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a thing where, I mean, like, this is very much, like, I don't know if I want to call it comfort horror, but this is easy watching horror for me. So when it comes to, like, ranking these films, I have 2 and 6 in my top spot. But again, like, which one is in the top, it kind of depends on my mood. I think this is actually one of the better directed films in the franchise. I think that 6 is one of the more cleverly written films in the franchise. So again, depending on my mood, I don't know when I saw this. I actually have, so I've talked in this podcast before about how, like, when I was younger, I wasn't able to watch R-rated movies. My dad would frequently just tell me the plots of movies and tell me what happened in them. This was one that he did a lot because this was, if not the first date, it's one of the first dates he went on with my mother back in 1981.
Oh, nice.
And my mother doesn't like horror movies. And so it was very much like, oh, she was doing this to, like, to kind of show how brave she was to me. But the thing that he always told me was, the girl pees under the bed.
Yes.
And it's the only time I can remember, honestly, of any film of a character getting so scared they piss themselves. Well, I'm sorry, a final girl getting so scared that she pissed herself while hiding from the killer.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the big reasons this film is such a favorite is that final girl too, right? Like, I know that she's generally a fan favorite character, isn't she, I think?
Oh, yeah.
Very much so. Jenny is a powerhouse of a final girl, which is interesting, though, because she doesn't really have much to do in this movie until that final stretch of the film. But while I actually do think a lot of this is just kind of, oh, we're just doing more of the same of the first movie, it is that final 20, 25 minutes that I think really elevates this film to another level.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that it's the same for me as in part one, actually. I think, like, for me, that film goes up a notch when Mrs. Voorhees enters the scenario, right? And I love the final act of the original with Mrs. Voorhees. These movies do kind of slightly lag in the middle sometimes for me, you know? Like, there's always that period in a Friday the 13th movie where you've got a scary opening sequence, then you introduce to all your characters, and then it's just like them playing board games or whatever for like a significant chunk of the movie before the horror kicks in, you know?
Yeah, I think that a big part of that too is how enjoyable these characters are to spend time with.
Absolutely.
And I don't really have that affinity for the characters in the first movie, but I do actually like pretty much every single character in this movie.
Yeah, that was going to be my response as well. I think the movies often end up playing in the shallow end in terms of characterization, but this film feels like it's doing a fairly decent job with at least 4 other of these supporting characters. Like, I think we're doing really good work with Vicky and Mark and to a lesser degree Scott and Terry, and then, you know, who could fucking care about Sandra and whatever that guy's name is,
Jeff.
Those are the kinds of characters that I expect to see in a Friday the 13th, where they are just walking body bags for Jason to murder. But I think this film does a fairly decent job of having some interesting characters that can pad the runtime until we finally get to Jenny.
Well, and let's be clear, if you take away the cold open of this movie, which includes a 5-minute-long recap of the climax of the first film, the movie proper is 70 minutes long.
Short and sweet.
Get to that feature runtime, baby.
Yeah.
But I will say that I do, as annoying as that recap is for taking so much of the runtime, I also kind of appreciate it. Like, it doesn't seem that far gone from what the Saw franchise would be doing like 20, 30 years later.
Well, that, and let's never forget that at the time that these films were coming out, VHS was barely a thing. So there were a lot of people who, if you either hadn't seen the first film or you hadn't seen it in a long time, like, i.e. a year or two,
then you needed that refresher, because what the fuck happened in the last film?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. I do love, though, that they decide to do it via a dream, right? Yes. Alice. So in amongst these flashbacks, you just get Alice going, it's just like tossing and turning in her bed for like 15 minutes.
Well, I was going to save this when we got to the actual plot, but so all of this, her entire scene, like, wasn't scripted. It was all improv. And so they were like, yeah, just lie on the bed and act like you're having a nightmare. Or that whole phone conversation with her mother, not scripted. She just made it up on the fly.
Oh, I love that.
That's interesting.
Just trying to put the pieces of my life back together.
And this is the only way I know how. And I was like, well, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It would have been nice even if it could have been, you know, calendar appointment with therapist tomorrow or something like that.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, she's got a really nice house, though.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you afford that on a camp counselor salary, but you do you, girl.
It's huge, isn't it? And again, this feels like one of those few sequences in the whole Friday the 13th franchise that's like a kind of stalking slasher sequence in just a house, right? Not in the camp or whatever as well.
Oh, and Joe and I are really big fans of establishing geography in a house. So even though we don't get a chase scene in this movie, I appreciate that we're just following her throughout this house, so we know the layout of this damn thing.
Yeah. Mm.
And we get a cat
jump scare and everything. But yeah, sorry, we're getting ahead.
Okay, I'll go into it. So, okay, how this film came to be. This film came out like just shy of a year after the first film. And following the success of that film, which in case y'all don't know, it grossed $40 million domestically on a $550,000 budget.
Ooh, easy money.
Despite being like critically like panned by pretty much every single critic out there.
So it's like every horror film ever.
Yes. Or at least of this era, I feel
like. Yeah.
Paramount Pictures began plans to make a sequel, and of course, the issue here was that pretty much all of the cast and the main villain of the original film, save for Adrienne King's Alice, are dead. So, Phil Scuderi, one of the three owners of Esquire Theaters, along with Steve Manazian and Bob Barsamian, who produced the original film, insisted that the sequel have Jason Voorhees, Pamela's son, even though his appearance in the original film was only meant to be a joke. Oh, before I get further, I should say most of this is coming from that Crystal Lake Memories documentary.
Of course. A classic.
A classic, absolutely. But of course, this makes no fucking sense, and Friday the 13th Part 2 does absolutely nothing to make this plausible. They just... Don't even try.
The scene where we try to walk through how Jason could be an adult and he's like lived in the woods all this time, blah, blah, blah. You're just like, no, stop it. Just stop.
Incredible. I have so much to say about the timeline and the chronology of this series as well. But anyway.
Yes. Well, okay. But this is why, though, whenever like I see horror fans get up in arms about like some continuity error or whatever in some newer horror film, I'm like, okay, but come on. You worship at the altar Friday the 13th and Halloween. Like, let's not fuck around here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Victor Miller, the writer of the original film, he says in an interview, like, no, like, Jason is 100% dead. And the makeup designer of that first film, Tom Savini, says the same thing because they offered him the same gig for this film. And he was like, that makes no fucking sense. Jason's dead. I'm going to go do The Burning instead.
Which, fantastic makeup.
Yes, yeah. Very fantastic. I think there's better kills in that movie than there are in this film. But this film did get butchered by the MPAA.
Oh, shocker. Shocker. I feel like every time we talk about one of these fucking movies, it's just like, and you're not really seeing the way it was intended to because censored.
Do y'all have the Scream Factory box set of these movies?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So do y'all watch like the slash scenes that show you the extra gore effects?
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know, these were pulled from a VHS tape from the person who would wind up doing the makeup for this film, Carl Fullerton. There's no sound. The quality is absolute shit.
It's so dark. You can barely see half of them.
Yes, yeah. But you do see the ice pit go through Alice's nose. But she also does this really bad thing where she like sticks her tongue out and it ruins the scene.
Oh, yeah.
You do get a full body shot of Jeff and Sandra getting killed. Like there's more bleeding on Scott's death when he's hung on, from the rope.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but honestly, watching it, you're kind of like, this was what they were up in arms about? Like,
yeah,
I don't really get it personally, but I think it's just like, it's just the times, I guess.
Yep. It's the early 80s.
But funnily enough, though, Stan Winston was supposed to replace Tom Savini, but then he had a scheduling conflict, which is when Carl Fullerton was brought in. So we could have had a Stan Winston Friday the 13th.
Interesting.
So Sean S. Cunningham, the director of the original film, wanted to move on to other things. In this case, 1982's Someone Is Watching. So his protege, Steve Miner, who was an associate producer on the first film and would go on to direct films like Friday the 13th Part 3, House, Halloween H2O, and Lake Placid, he was brought on to direct in his place.
aka bangers. This guy.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, you said it, Trace. The direction in this film, I'm saying elevate, but not elevated.
Yes.
The direction in this film really takes the material to a new level.
Well, so Mike, I'm curious, because I came into this kind of hard, being like, this is the only one I find genuinely scary in the entire franchise. I'm curious your thoughts on that. Like, given Miner's direction, especially in that last act, like, do you find this scary?
Yeah, do you know what? I feel exactly the same as you. I think for a franchise that is not particularly scary in a real visceral way, this movie is the closest to that. And I think that is absolutely partly that's Steve Miner's direction. That moment when Ginny says someone is in the room with us, is a really chilling moment. I wish Friday the 13th had more moments like that, you know? It's really, really chilling. And I actually like the look of Jason in this movie as well. He's scarier looking than in any of the other films, I think.
I do too. For me, the big moment is when she finally makes it to Jason's shack, and like there's a shot where like the window on the left side of the screen, and you can see Jason running through the window, but Ginny doesn't see him yet.
Yeah,
that's the scariest part of this whole franchise for me.
Even the generic-y jump scares are really effective in this movie. Like, you know, at least two of them are coming, and then as you said, Mike, I think I talked over you. There's a literal cat scare.
Yes, there is. I know. Yeah, there are some big jump scares in this, aren't there? Yeah,
they're just surprisingly effective. Like, I'm not used to a Friday film actually getting me in that way.
Yeah, there's also that quite chilling moment, a similar kind of moment when the random cop that dies, right, when he pulls over in the car, and you get that shot of Jason just running into the woods across the road as well. It's those little fleeting blink and you miss the moments that are really good in this.
Well, so I don't think there's much fun casting news about this, except for Adrienne King, because there's a very well-known story about how she was pursued by an obsessed fan after the success of the original film. And so there's two sides to this story here. One is that she wished her role to be as small as possible. However, in that Crystal Lake Memories documentary, she doesn't really address that part of it, but she does, like, someone comes in and basically says that her agent asked for too much money, and the studio said fuck no and basically wrote her out of the film.
Oh, she's the original Neve Campbell.
Wow. Yes.
So yeah, I'm sure she felt like shit too, because it's like she shows up, no script, hey, improv all your scenes, and they shot it in like a day.
Can you imagine?
Jesus. Yeah. And I guess this is what sort of started this trend that we got in a lot of 80s slashers, particularly, right, of kind of killing off the final girl from the previous installment in the straight away in the next installment, you know?
Or just completely forgetting about her, because we don't hear a thing about Ginny after this.
Yeah.
It's wild. It's like, do you not understand that people, sure, like Jason, you know, we like our killers, we think they're interesting, but also they're not really characters. They're just mechanisms to up the body count and move the narrative along. I think one of the issues that people who either cry misogyny or who just don't like that 80s wave of slashers, one of the things that they struggle with is just this disinterest from the creatives to actually invest in characters. So it's like, you give us a Ginny and then you don't think we want to see more of her? What the fuck are you thinking?
Yeah. But we're also churning these out. I mean, look, the screenplay for this movie is, I'll just say it, basic, but it's a lot of what like the production does to kind of make those things jump off the page when they weren't jumping off the page just in script form.
and this is it, and this is the franchise that kind of really set in stone this kind of template, right? I mean, like, we'd only had one Halloween movie by this point. We didn't have any Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and they were churning out these Friday the 13th movies year after year, right? And it's the franchise that created that template of, we are just gonna swap in and out various different characters, but Jason is the star, right? And this is where this kind of begins, it feels like.
Yes, absolutely.
It's that, and it also feels like, oh, if we don't have another one of these films next year, people are going to forget that we exist, or we're leaving money on the table.
Well, okay, put a pin in that, because when I discuss the box office for this film, I want to have that discussion as well.
Okay. Yeah.
This is also, I think, the only time where Jason was played by two actors. If I got that wrong, I apologize. I did try to research this, and I think I'm correct. But actor Warrington Gillette lost out on the role of Paul, so they offered him the role of Jason, which he accepted. But unfortunately, Gillette couldn't do the stunts required of the part. So, okay. There's a couple different stories here again. Apparently, he played Jason unmasked at the end of the film. So he's in the makeup. Where stuntman Steve Deskowitz apparently played the masked Jason throughout the rest of the film. However, this is weird because Laura Marie Taylor, who plays Vicky in that documentary, says that Gillette was her Jason. She doesn't see the unmasked Jason in this film. Unless when Jason's stalking her and kills her, like, they just didn't bother putting the mask on him in those POV shots. I don't know maybe. The answer to that.
Yeah.
Another fun fact, though, in the opening scene, Jason was played by a woman, the only woman to ever play Jason. Costume designer Ellen Letter, who also came up with his disguise, the potato sack.
Oh, love that. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the feet as the Itsy Bitsy Spider is going across, that's her. I don't think the hand that kills Alice is her, but it's definitely like that first shot of the feet, that's a woman.
So wild.
Yeah. So by the end of September 1980, 4 months after the release of the original, they were already in production on the sequel. New to the team was 22-year-old Frank Mancuso Jr., who was just out of college and would become the driving force behind the franchise for many years to come. Now, why is this 22-year-old twink fresh out of college given such a prestigious spot on this film?
Do we know he's a twink?
You know what? There were some pictures, and maybe he was a bit, he looked a bit more athletic than your standard twink. But
okay.
His father was the president of Paramount Pictures.
Nepo baby.
Oh, maybe not the original, but definitely one of them.
Oh, definitely not the original. We had Nepo babies in the 50s.
But yeah, so like its predecessor, you know, this film had difficulty receiving an R rating. A total of 48 seconds had to be cut from the film in order to avoid the X. We've already gone through a bunch of them. I might go into more detail as we go through the plot. But the other salacious story with this, though, is that actress Marta Kober, who plays Sandra, was only 16 when they filmed this. And I guess, you know, by the time this comes out, we've already seen Totally Killer. And apparently in the 80s, they don't check anything and there's no privacy or anything. So... there was a scene of her going full frontal. They shot a 16-year-old girl in full frontal. And this was in the VHS footage that Fullerton had that he gave to Scream Factory, you know, for the extra kill scenes. But obviously they cut that out because gross.
Yeah, not appropriate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So the film was released theatrically. They filmed this in a month. So like they filmed it basically for the whole month of October. It ends in early November. Released theatrically on May 1st, 1981, bringing in $6.4 million its opening weekend. And it goes on to gross just, quote unquote, $21.7 million against a budget of $1.25 million. And this is a little more than half the domestic gross of the first film, but it's also like, what, a 21,000% increase over the budget?
It's huge money compared to the budget, but when you look at what the original film did, it feels like, ooh, this is half the gross. So, in a way, I imagine they looked at it as a bit of a flop.
But here's the funny thing, though. So part three grosses about $34 million the next year. And then there's a 2-year gap between part three and the final chapter. And the final chapter grosses $32 million. So I just I don't know like what you're talking about, you know, where it's like, oh, we had to get these out one after the other because otherwise interest would wane. I think maybe the draw of three was the 3D aspect, which is why it made more money.
Absolutely.
And then the final chapter is, you know, the final, quote unquote, chapter.
well, basically, after part two, every movie has its, like, gimmick, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like, it's the 3D one. It's the, quote unquote, final one. Then it's the, quote unquote, new beginning. Then it's the, oh, no, Jason's back. Like, they had to find some way of kind of selling each and every installment after part two, didn't they?
Right.
And that's, you know, again, like I said, I think this is a lot of more of the same. But I do think this is just a much better, more finessed version of that original film. Even, I was going to say, even though we don't get Mrs. Voorhees, but we do get Mrs. Voorhees in this movie. Wow.
Yeah. I was wondering, Trace, do you know if the sort of hologram overlay of Betsy Palmer in the end of this film, did they bring her back or did they just find a way to repurpose footage?
They did bring her back. And it was so funny because I had it must be the Mandela effect because I know that she's talked about the first film as being a piece of shit. But they asked her back, and so I had it in my head that she told them no, and so they used repurposed footage. They brought her in, did some voiceover dialogue, and shot her, and that's her.
Okay.
Wow.
Cool.
But yeah, so this film was the 35th highest grossing film of 1981, facing strong competition from other horror films like Omen 3, The Evil Dead, The Howling, My Bloody Valentine, Happy Birthday to Me, Graduation Day, Halloween 2 and The Burning, and that's just like the heavy hitters. This was a big slasher year, so there's probably a bunch of like shitty ones that had just disappeared into the ether that also came out that year.
Oh yeah, it's the ultimate slasher year, isn't it, really? 1981.
Yes, it's the year with the most number of slashers ever released.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Well, critics hated this. We've got a 28% on Rotten Tomatoes with an average score of 4.4 out of 10, a 26 out of 100 on Metacritic, and Letterboxd users have given an 8, generous 6 out of 10.
But those seem low. I'm not going to lie.
I mean, we have to compare it to the others, but I think that's pretty good. Because I think you have people that are like, this is absolute horseshit. Like, this franchise sucks. And then, like, right. It's super fans who are giving it 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
yes, me, noted super fan of the Friday the 13th franchise.
Before I pass it over to you, Joe, I do want to say, so I am going to bring in Roger Ebert's review of this just because I think it's so fucking funny.
Here we go again.
He hated this movie. He gave it a 0.5 star. And he said, this film is a cross between the mad slasher and dead teenager genres. About 2 dozen movies a year feature a mad killer going berserk, and they're all about as bad as this one. Some have a little more plot, some have a little less. It doesn't matter. And so Ebert would never write another print review for any Friday the 13th film after that.
Okay.
Finishing his review of this film saying, this review will suffice for the Friday the 13th film of your choice.
Wow. Honestly, just such a broad generalization and so dickish. Like, guess what? We all have films that we don't always enjoy as film critics. Mm-hmm. And it's our responsibility to either give them a fair crack or not be inherently dismissive of the fact that they are connecting with a certain audience.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, Siskel is also the one who like spoiled the end of the first film in his review in an attempt to dissuade people from going to see it.
Right. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
but yeah, so that is Friday the 13th part 2. Let's talk about this cold open.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm curious, when you two watched this movie, the opening sequence, to me, I immediately went to Halloween, even though we obviously were getting point of view shots in the first Friday the 13th. But to me, this feels so much like, hey, everybody's seen Halloween, right?
Well, that's kind of what the first one is, too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, but no, I completely agree. This opening scene makes it feel more like your Halloween-type slasher, doesn't it? For sure. And again, I like the kind of creepy shots of the kids singing the nursery rhyme. Like, I don't know, it feels like it's going for a more classic, I don't know, almost gothic-y horror or something in this opening sequence, yeah.
But it's also a different setting than what we're used to for this franchise, because we're not in the woods, we're not in a cabin, we're in what I presume to be a suburbia? City?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like the fact, too, that we open with a kid. I think that's part of the other reason I think of Halloween is because in that cold open to John Carpenter's film, we're following kids as they're trick-or-treating, right? And it seems like, oh, is that kind of what we're doing here? The answer is no. We're literally temporarily following a child, and then we just veer directly into Alice's apartment. But it's still interesting.
It almost has a little Georgie from It vibe, I think. Like, I think It starts with the kids singing Itsy Bitsy Spider as well in the rain like that. So, yeah, that's the weird little connection there. But, yeah, I like it. I think it's quite a nice way to sort of start this movie off.
But, okay, can we talk about whatever the fuck Alice is wearing in this scene? Green plaid overalls over, I think, a green shirt.
Incredible.
Oh boy. I just wear this casually around your house, I guess, or when you're sleeping in the middle of the bed, like not even like on a pillow.
You know what, Trace? This is what trauma looks like. It forces you into one single color block in terms of your outfits, and yeah, you don't know how to use a pillow anymore. Yeah, so we get this extended recap of number one, as we mentioned, via nightmare. She's tossing and turning. And then, you know, like any good horror movie, when she fends off a phone call from her mom, who, you know, wants her to come home, and she's like, no, I got to do my own thing. After that, she takes a shower, because of course she does.
Okay, but I actually thought this was really clever. This almost felt metatextual to me. Like, I mean, look, anytime we see a shower in a horror film, I feel like we're referencing Psycho. But specifically with this, because we get that POV of the camera approaching the shower. And it's not a jump scare, but the way she opens it and just looks directly at the camera, i.e. the audience, I thought
it's
this
startling.
I thought it was a really fun little nod to what I'm assuming was an intentional homage to Psycho.
Yeah. And also there's that slight metatextual element to the fact that we're killing off our final girl in the opening scene. You know, there's a Janet Leigh vibe to that too, that kind of misdirection. Absolutely. Maybe, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, Because I think it's because, hey, the trailer for this film just repeats what we do in the first film, where we basically show the lead up to every single fucking death, and they just count from, you know, 14 to 26. And I always forget, you know, oh yeah, people back here didn't just have access to trailers. Like, they had to see them in the theater. So, like, spoilers, I guess, didn't really matter that much. But I do wonder who was walking into this and started watching this movie being like, oh, yay, like, our girl's back and, like, we're fine.
It's true. I forgot about those trailers. Like, again, it's the way in which these movies literally sell themselves on the body count, basically. Yes. Right, I mean, that is literally what these films are. They're just body count movies.
I mean, the tagline for this is "the body count continues ...
Amazing.
We're not going to talk to you about the plot. We're not going to try to sell you on some fantastic new adventure. It's really just like, come to watch teenagers get killed.
Yeah. But remember, that's how it happened in the first one, because Cunningham took out an ad in Variety or something that just said Friday the 13th coming soon. And he had no fucking script ready. This was just a, hey, are people interested in this? And lo and behold, you do like a gimmick, like just the name Friday the 13th. And yes, people are interested.
Yeah. And I'm going to correct myself before anybody sends an angry tweet or email. I said that they are like high school students or like young adults, and obviously these are all at least college age into their early 20s.
Well, except for Sandra.
Well, there's notwithstanding.
Oh, God.
The other thing that I really notice about this opening sequence is how closely Miner is shooting this. Like, Trace, you mentioned, you know, the shower curtain opens and we see Alice. We are in her fucking face. Like, it is so close to the action. It feels both intimate but also intrusive.
It's claustrophobic in a way.
I just liked it because it feels different from a conventional POV shot that we sometimes get in these films, where it feels like the camera is about 10 feet away from all the actors.
It's voyeuristic in a way, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And actually, there is a lot of... The Friday the 13th movies in general have this thing, and this movie has it too, where, you know, you've got like a chase scene in the woods, and it's basically just a big, slightly boring wide shot of just one person running from left to right in the frame, right? And these movies can't really get away from that a lot of the time. But yeah, it's nice to see something looking a little bit different in this opening.
So we find the decapitated head of Mrs. Voorhees in the fridge, which suggests to us that Jason just carries his mom's head around with
him. I mean, look, I don't need to know, but I want to know. Where is Alice's house in relation to Camp Crystal Lake?
Right, exactly. Like, did he get a load of public transport to get here? How did
he ride?
I can't imagine him, like, doing his research into finding her home address and all of that stuff as well. Like, how did this happen?
And also, I don't know if this is what it is, but it almost looks like a coastal town. And I don't know why I'm thinking that. I feel like maybe in the rain. I'm like, oh, there's water nearby. But I'm just like, now you gotta walk your ass all the way back to fucking Camp Crystal Lake with your shack and your shitty toilet. Okay.
Yeah. And is he presumably wearing that sack over his head the whole time?
I guess we should point out, too, like, I mean, I don't know if this was... Because they referenced the town that dreaded sundown in that documentary, but I don't know if that was a thing where, like, again, this costume designer was like, oh, that was a popular thing back in the time. Because her reasoning for giving Jason the potato sack was, this is something that someone living in a shack in the woods would probably have easy access to, like this type of material.
As opposed to a hockey mask.
Well, I mean, you know, we got to get Shelly out there in that third one.
Oh, God, don't ever talk to me about Shelly.
Everyone hates Shelly. I feel so bad for Shelly.
I mean, who's worse, Ted or Shelly?
No, you know what, though? I feel like people really rag on the... is it Chris? Is that her name in that movie, The Final Girl? I actually really like that because that bitch just goes insane at the end of the movie. Like,
oh, she's great.
Yeah.
She's hauled off in a cop car. Oh, okay. Not to go divert too far away, but there is a really scary shot in that movie at the very end where she's in the boat in the pond and she looks up into the barn and sees the unmasked Jason see her through the window.
Yeah.
And he gives this like really like creepy, delighted, like, laugh that you can't hear. You just see him clearly laughing as he then starts to run towards her. Ooh. It's scary as fuck.
So you
admit there's another Friday film that's scary.
That part is scary. I feel like people don't rank 3 very high in their rankings. I like 3 a lot.
Yeah, I think parts 1, 2, and 3 are the only three that feel like... I like the early years of Friday the 13th movies. Like, I like these, the first four, when they had this kind of slightly grainier, grittier, early 80s vibe, and Jason wasn't this huge Kane Hodder-like presence, right, in these early movies. But also, those first three movies particularly do have final girls, right, as well. Like, they do have characters that you want to support and root for in, right, like Chris and Ginny and Alice. And I feel like beyond the first three, that kind of disappears a little bit, doesn't it? I think.
Well, I think because in Final Chapter, they're like, we have whoever Corey Feldman's sister is, but we're splitting time in that movie between like the two sides, like the kids at the camp and then the family. So it loses that aspect, I think, a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is wild, too, because these films are never hurting for characters. There's often too many of them, and we don't get to know them well enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so Alice bites it pretty early. She gets, as we've said, an ice pick through the temple, and this is an interesting weapon choice for Jason. A little bit dainty, not gonna lie.
Right? Well, yeah. It's a woman's weapon.
As Sharon Stone would tell us, yes.
Oh, but as we already said, this Jason was played by a woman. Maybe not his hands, but those feet.
Jason's just experimenting with their gender identity in these early moments of the film. So, you know what? An ice pick, too light. I think I'm going to go with more machete spear action later.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, so like, because I feel like whenever people say, oh, like, what's Jason's weapon? I mean, fuck, in Scream 4, that question is asked. And it's a machete. And I was like, what? Because I feel like he uses a wide variety of weapons. Like, he doesn't just use a machete, but is it because he uses that one the most often?
I think it's, it's this weird thing where I think when people think of Friday the 13th, they're actually picturing part 6 onwards, right? They're thinking that big, hulking, zombie-like Jason with the hockey mask carrying a machete. And we don't really get that until much later on in the series, it feels like, right? And I really like this kind of scrawnier, scrappier Jason that we get in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
He somehow makes more sense in this form. Like, I've seen a lot of speculation online that it's when he gets reanimated and he basically becomes a godlike figure.
Yes.
That's when he can become hulking and unkillable. And as a result, it makes sense to hire someone who looks like a wrestler to play him. But yeah, I mean, this is a guy who's purportedly lived in the woods for a number of years, feasting on what, berries and potatoes from this sack. So yeah. I would expect him to be a little scrawny.
Well, also arguably a dog, but we see a dog corpse in this movie that looks just like Muffin, but then Muffin comes in later. So I guess there were just two
fake out. What the fuck?
Brilliant. That little Muffin moment at the end there, Muffin, as well. Amazing.
Oh, I mean, okay. Also, I think that replicates that canoe scare in that first movie very, very, very well.
Okay, so Alice is dead. This is around the 12-minute mark of the film, so we're basically around 1 hour to go.
And 2 minutes of opening credits.
Correct.
Amazing.
Yes.
And can I just say, love the score for these movies, right? It's so intense.
It goes hard.
So hard.
It's just like, this score feels like it's for, forgive me, a better film.
No, I don't even disagree with you. And so I actually have this score on vinyl, and one of my friends came over and he was like, oh, I don't really like, he's like, I'll listen to like movie scores, but I don't want to listen to Friday the 13th part 2. It's a little too like intense for if you're just working from home. And I was like, I know, but like
it's so good.
When I listen to a score, I actually do visualize the scene that it plays over, like as I'm listening to it. Mm. And so it's like a way to watch the movie without watching the movie.
Yeah, actually, you guys mentioned earlier the Crystal Lake Memories. I think I've come to sort of enjoy watching that more than watching through the whole films, you know? just like, give me the highlights with the interviews, you know? And sometimes I find that a little bit more entertaining than rewatching these films multiple times.
Well, I also, I mean, for me personally, I like watching people involved in the films talk about the legacy, the release, the reception, being frank about, this is like a piece of shit movie, but like, look what happened to it. Like, I just, I find those conversations very interesting. And so, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with Friday the 13th. Like, I covered them extensively when I did a slasher season of my podcast. And they're so interesting. They're so interesting for so many reasons to talk about. And lots of the stuff we've already said, really. And the way in which, even though Halloween did kind of design the template, it was really Friday the 13th that kind of made it a template, right? And there's all these kind of interesting things to talk about around these movies. And again, I do love, and I don't mean to be mean about these films because I do enjoy them, but I think sometimes they're more interesting to talk about than they are to watch. You know?
Yeah. I mean, particularly, as you said, this franchise, because it got into so many troubles. I'm always most fascinated by the MPA because I think it's almost... It's like a trapped in amber glimpse into the past where you can really see what were we focusing on. And I think it future forecasts a lot of the issues that other horror films will butt up against as they come into wide release. Okay, so we got credits. And when we come back, we are reintroduced to Crazy Ralph, who is played by Walt Gorney. Once again, the other actor that reprises their role in this film. Basically, this is the harbinger. If you can watch these scenes with him without thinking of Cabin in the Woods, you're a better movie watcher than me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Crazy Ralph is watching Sandra, who, as you mentioned, Trace, is played by Marta Kober, as well as Jeff, who is played by Bill Randolph. They are calling someone that we have not met yet named Ted on the payphone, and it's your favorite gag, Trace. Something is happening in the back. Their truck is being towed.
I love it when like something like chaotic is happening in the background but the characters we're focusing on like have no idea, like they don't even notice it. Such a good gag for me.
Yeah,
but also I feel like I always forget this happens in this scene, and then that it's actually Ted who was in cahoots with the tow truck guy.
yeah I'd kind of completely forgotten about this moment as well. Yeah,
I think part of the reason is that it ultimately doesn't really come to anything. It introduces Ted as a bit of a prankster. We'll see this again when he jumps out at the end of Paul's story by the campfire. You know, it gives us a bit of idea of who he is. Not much about Sandra and Jeff. I would argue that they are probably the weakest characters in this movie because all we know is that they want to fuck.
Okay, I find this very interesting because I was surprised to hear you like single out Terry and Scott earlier, which, but it is interesting because I feel like they have the least screen time out of all these characters.
I think they make a bigger impression.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we haven't said Ted is played by Stuart Charno. He was in cahoots with Max, the tow truck driver, but he ends up getting a ride with them because we are en route to counselor training. But we end up getting blocked by a large tree that has fallen across the road. And as the boys clear it away, that's when we see the sign for Camp Crystal Lake, a.k.a. Camp Blood.
Camp Blood. And Sandra will not let this shit go. She wants to go there, goddammit.
Yeah, like this is her defining character trait. Sandra, do you just want to go to Pound Town at Camp Blood? Is that what's turning you on?
Honestly, the fact that we don't get a sex scene between them in one of these cabins is robbery.
Well, I mean, they're getting cock blocked by the cop.
Sure.
Okay, so we make it to camp and we've got a bevy of hot counselors, including our disabled character Mark, who is played by queer actor Tom McBride.
Okay, I'm gonna step in here. Yeah, I want to do it now. So I don't remember when I learned that he was gay. And of course, if you don't know, he did die from AIDS-related complications in 1995. He actually, through HIV/AIDS, got a disease called PML, which is progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy.
Ooh, you practiced that since the last time we talked.
I did. This is a disease of the white matter of the brain caused by a viral infection that targets cells that make the myelin, the material that insulates nerve cells and neurons. And so he has had a lot of seizures in the weeks leading up to his death. So I went to his Wikipedia, and it was a documentary made in 1996. It's a 45-minute long documentary. You can find this on YouTube, and we will link to it in the show notes. It's basically like it's shot on video by one of his friends, and it's interviews with him. I'm not quite sure of the timeline.
I think it's the months leading up to his death.
Months. Okay, so did you watch this, Joe?
I did, yeah. It's about 45 minutes. If you want to see him naked, you can see full dong. It is upsetting, I will confess. Like, it starts off and he's very proud and boastful about his status as an A-list gay because he's very hot and he's kind of made it as a model and an actor. And by the end of the film, he's almost nonverbal because he's so ill. So
he's paralyzed.
Yeah, it's pretty upsetting.
I think it's a good document. There's not really like a through line here. We're just kind of like, it's like slices of life almost as we check in, and he'll talk about random topics. I will say it's a very interesting time capsule into this particular lifestyle at this particular time.
Yeah.
there is some bottom shaming on his part where, like, someone asks him, like, oh, if you were getting fucked a lot, would you feel more like a woman? And he says, absolutely, because he is apparently a power top. But I also kind of respect his candor, which I guess he's in his mind, he's thinking, like, I'm going to die soon, so I can say whatever the fuck I want. Also, the internet doesn't. Very frank. And so I think some of it makes him come across like a bit of a jerk sometimes. Yeah. But again, when you put it in the context of, again, this time period, what he's going through, it does make sense. But I just want to kind of warn people who have maybe been thirsting after this man since they've seen this film.
Well, he's a human being. I mean, he's got some flaws. There's a couple of things where you just think, oh, well, this doesn't age very well. But as you said, this is probably a relatively common, or maybe a little bit more common than we might have expected, mindset for, yeah, mid-90s, somebody who has survived the AIDS epidemic, quote unquote, but not really.
And to be clear, bottom shaming exists today still. So it's not like it's new.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious, Mike, did you know that this actor was queer?
I did, but only through...
Because you had done your own research?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, when I covered it on my own podcast, it was only then that I found out, really, looking into the film. And then also, you know, everyone's really sweet about him on the Crystal Lake Memories documentary, aren't they? I think. Like, they tell stories about how all of the women had the hots for him. And, you know, he had to kind of be like, ah, no, you know, not my type, obviously. And like, yeah, but it sounded like everyone absolutely loved him on set.
Right.
But by all accounts, he was the one. I mean, even like the friends that are with him in this documentary, like, honestly, the hardest part for me is there's a part of the documentary where he basically decides to leave New York. He's going to go back to Florida and basically live out the remainder of his days with his mom in Florida. Mm-hmm. And you watch all of his friends say goodbye to him as he gets in the car. And like one of them just starts crying. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Like, it's interesting seeing this subject who's like, I know I'm going to die in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the other thing that we haven't acknowledged is that he is not disabled in real life. He was able-bodied. So I guess another instance of things that we probably wouldn't do that way had this film been made now.
I will say, though, watching Vicky try to roll him down this hill, this camp is not...
No.
They have a lot of accessibility options.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there is a ramp to get into the cottage, but then, yeah, like, when you see him die, and it just feels like insult to injury when you see the wheelchair go down this giant fucking flight of stairs. Oh. It's like, wow, okay, movie.
I think he gets the beanest death in this movie, but I like it. Like, it's so ridiculous that I kind of can't help but laugh, because he goes down like a first small set of stairs, and then we cut, and all of a sudden it's like the fucking Exorcist stairs.
Yeah, it is. It's like that scene is often like cited as one of the fans' like favorite kills in the franchise, isn't it? And it is like it is kind of weird, and I wonder if it is because it is just a particularly nasty one, isn't it? Again, it's not just like blink and you miss it. There's something kind of extra prolonged and mean-spirited about it, which is often what you want in a slasher film too, you know?
I think it's also because it's so memorable, right? Like, often the kills that we like the most are the ones that we remember the most, and this does have that unique quality. Also, because we do get the shot of the machete in his face, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay, yeah. And it's just like, I mean, you just don't really see that a lot.
Well, and particularly in this movie where there's only a couple of deaths we actually see on screen. You know, there's a couple that are off screen, or there's some where we start to see it and then we cut midway through. So this one is very much like, you get to see this character die.
Yeah, and there's like the thunder and lightning and everything as well, and it's just quite a cool looking kind of set piece, isn't it? Well, I think.
Yeah,
and a freeze frame to white out to transition to the next scene.
Yeah.
Which always weirds me out. I'm like, wait, a whiteout? Okay, what an interesting transition choice.
Yeah.
So also at this camp, we have pervy dark-haired Scott, who is played by Russell Todd. I will confess, between these two men, hunka-hunka this movie.
Yeah, very much so.
almost everyone in this film is really hot
They're
in one
gorgeous.
Way or another, right?
They're gorgeous, yeah. Because Terry is up next, and I'm not going to lie, this is interesting. You know, Terry is a very confident woman. She's obviously incredibly fit. Kristen Baker is in fantastic fucking shape, but I love that she basically does not own a shirt that covers her midriff, and she does not own shorts that cover the bottom part of her butt cheeks.
as we see in quite prolonged close-ups for quite a lot of this film as well.
Oh, I mean, look, the MPAA had issues with the gore in this movie. They had no issue with full bush.
Clearly. But also, I mean, if you've got a body like this, fucking show it off. She is amazingly gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're having this meeting. It is being led by Paul, who is played by John Fury. And midway through the meeting, Ginny, aka Amy Steele, final girl extraordinaire, shows up in her backfiring VW bug. And of course, this pisses him off. Question for you two. What does the line, "This place is starting to look like a Burger King," mean?
It's a very good question. I have absolutely no idea.
Why, Paul, when you look at a bunch of cars in a parking lot, do you think of a Burger King?
Like a drive-thru or something? I don't know.
Maybe.
Was it a hangout spot in 1981?
I don't know.
I will say, so question for y'all. Do you think that this... Because I feel like immediately, Ginny is kind of the bad girl. She's, like, she's bad breaking girl. The rules. And yeah. So I feel like watching this, and maybe because it's 81, we don't have these quote-unquote rules yet. Mm-hmm. But I feel like you're kind of meant to think that she's not going to be long for this world based on how she's a rule breaker.
Yeah, I was watching it today, and my wife was sitting next to me. She'd never seen it before. And at this moment when Ginny appeared, she was like, oh, so let me guess, she's probably going to die first, right? And that was literally what she said. Because, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Trace. Like, she's introduced as the bad girl that would probably, in certain other slasher movies, get punished for being the bad girl, right?
Mm-hmm. Right? And we don't see her fuck Paul, but she's definitely fucking Paul.
Definitely. Yeah, because they have a kissy makeout session a little bit later, which I'll confess I find deeply disappointing because Paul sucks.
He does. Just like, he really
Ginny,
does.
You're clearly introduced as a much more interesting, well-rounded character. No real shade on Paul. I mean, the character doesn't get much to do. He's the person in charge of the camp, so obviously he's going to be a bit more straight-laced. But the minute that we saw them making out, I just thought, girl, no, you can do better.
Well, the movie also doesn't give a shit about him because he just leaves the movie and we have no idea what happened to him.
Where is Paul? We don't know.
We don't know.
Same with Ted.
Oh, Ted gets off scot-free, man. He's going to come back to this. You know what? I'm a firm believer that he's probably the one that found everything and called the cops.
Oh, yeah.
This movie basically says, if you're going to be a camp counselor, your best bet to avoid getting murdered is to get absolutely plastered in town.
Basically.
So that night at the campfire, Paul repeats the 5-year-old urban legend about Crystal Lake and the murders and how the girl who survived disappeared. And then this is when Ted leaps out and scares everyone.
Ooh. It's a good scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. Okay, so I think, Mike, you said you wanted to gently try to figure out some of the timeline. Do you think 5 years is enough time to have passed?
It's incredible. I mean, I don't know. I guess so. I guess maybe it's enough time that it's still recent enough that people kind of know about this thing, but been far enough away that I guess, you know, stuff can happen around this lake again and not be too big a deal. But I just love this idea that I think part one, even though it came out in 1980, was set in 1979, technically.
Because they filmed it then.
Which means this is set in the future, right? This is set in 1984 at the time this movie came out. And then I think parts 3 and 4 all take place across the same night.
Well... Oh, that's what I missed, Joe. We have also covered Jason Goes to Hell. So I don't know if y'all were yelling at me. I remember that. But so basically, given the timeline for all these films, I want to say Jason Goes to Hell is supposed to take place in 2008.
Yes, yeah, I think it does. Ridiculous. I think I laid out like the whole timeline at one point, and and so I think, you know, I can't remember exactly, but I think at this point in time, i.e. 2023, Jason should be frozen, right? He's in stasis right now.
Yeah.
And so you can't make any other movies that are set at this particular time in the chronology of Friday the 13th.
It explains why we haven't gotten any new ones. It has nothing to do with legalities. It's just that Jason's still on ice.
I'm sorry, or you can do that and just not explain it.
Okay, so yes, we've had the scare out. We basically introduced everybody, however tangentially. And then we move into let's give each of these characters a little bit more shading. So we see Scott dancing with Muffin the dog in an effort to woo Terry. We've got Ginny winning a game of chess against a very perplexed looking Paul. Like, how did I get beaten by this girl?
You know what, though? It's better than the Monopoly scene in that first movie, which I think goes on for 100 hours.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is it. That's the main thing I remember about the first Friday the 13th.
Right?
It's just Monopoly.
Look, I am on record. The first film ranks in the bottom half of the franchise for me. I love the Mrs. Voorhees stuff, but I think it's so fucking boring.
Yeah, I mean, yes, you're probably right. And I think the thing is that for me, there's not a huge amount of difference in any of them. And again, that sounds like I'm being mean on the whole franchise, but there are parts of all of them that I love, but there are chunks of all of them. Again, it's the Monopoly chunk in every film that I glaze over.
Wait, I'm sorry. Also, I feel compelled to mention this. There is a black counselor in that campfire scene, and we never see this person again.
Oh, yeah. Because this movie is white as a mayonnaise jar.
Well, there's a part later. Oh, it's whenever Mark and Vicky are trying to hook up, and he's like, oh, well, Tim's in my cabin. And I was like, who's Tim?
Yes. There were actually, like,
there's a bunch more.
Yeah.
It's just we don't bother to get to know any of them because it's like, no, they're not going to get killed by Jason. So you don't need to know them.
I guess it's like, did everyone else just go to the bar or somewhere else that night?
I think so.
Yeah. So we're really just following the people who stayed behind and then Ginny and Paul who come back from the bar.
Right. Well, Paul basically murders Sandra and Jeff secondhand because they would have gone to that bar.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he's got to live with that for the rest of his life if he's not already
dead.
Who knows?
Speaking of death, we've got Crazy Ralph's death here. He dies by garrote outside of the cottage.
Mm-hmm. Love a good garrote.
Yeah, so it's, again, a very interesting choice for Jason. Not sure what this is made of. Like, is there a piano lurking somewhere around Crystal Lake?
I was thinking it was barbed wire.
It could be that.
Yes, yeah. I assumed it was barbed wire as well, yeah. But again, there's something kind of creepy looking about that moment. I don't know. It's like, I like the kills in this. I like that they're not all just a big machete to the face and that's it, you know?
Agreed. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So the next morning, the group sets out on a team-building forest hike. This is when Muffin meets Jason, and we think, oh, okay, well, that dog is surely dead.
Yes.
We also have Ginny briefly using Chekhov's chainsaw.
Yes! Okay, so literally in my notes, I put, how does this chainsaw not come back later?
It does.
And it does.
Ever so briefly.
I forgot.
And this is also where Sandra really starts to lean on Jeff that she wants to go to Camp Blood. So they do go, and we discover what we believe at the time to be Muffin's mutilated corpse. But it will not be.
I think it even has the pink bow.
It's just, how do you kill the only dog we've seen on screen thus far, and then later on walk it back and never introduce another dog?
Doesn't this also feel like a Halloween homage, though? Because Michael does kill a dog in that movie and eat it.
I am sure that that was supposed to be Muffin, and then they realized they needed a moment of calm to set us up for the big jump scare. Therefore, let's just have a little fake out with Muffin being still alive, right? Like, I feel like that was the only reason.
And we've got to get into post-production. This movie comes out in like a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have time to fix that shit.
Yeah, we need something sweet and wholesome to have some sweet, wholesome music so that we can then scare the shit out of you all with Jason bursting through the window. Yeah.
Yes, but I mean, honestly, if we have to walk back Muffin's desk so that we can get that jump scare...
Worth it.
Worth it.
Absolutely.
And the dog doesn't die.
There we go. Well, a dog dies,
but not the dog.
R.I.P. whatever dog that was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a fan video waiting in the wings to be made where it's just like some poor girl around this lake is like, Bitsy?
Yes.
Bitsy?
If this was the Saw franchise, there'd be another whole movie set in the same chronology as this that would show you a different perspective and other people dying. Like, what really happened to Paul and Ted and this dog, you know?
I feel like, oh God, I'm sure people are yelling at us, but I feel like maybe it said somewhere that in the script Paul died, or there was something filmed that showed him in the ambulance too. But again, this may be the Mandela effect where I'm just imagining this.
I cannot recall, but yeah. Okay, so Jeff and Sandra are discovered by the cop, who is played by Jack Marks, and he brings them back to Paul, and Paul doesn't really care about punishing them. So he says, okay, well, you two can't do anything. And the cop is very disappointed, but it doesn't matter because he's about to die in the woods when he stumbles into the cabin and he is murdered with the sharp end of a hammer.
So the slash scenes, you definitely get a longer shot of the hammer hitting his skull and a big splatter of blood flying out of it, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
But also this asshole, like, hey, this is a one lane street and he just blocks traffic to go chase Jason into the woods.
Yes.
He thinks that there's a murder on the loose.
I, But what you said earlier, Mike, though, you get the glimpse. This is the first glimpse of the potato sack, and it's such a quick shot that it actually is kind of scary.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
There's something creepy about it, isn't there? I really like that little glimpse. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's surprising. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising, but it is how often the films just rely on a point of view to convey some kind of sense of menace, whereas something fleeting like this is actually, I would argue, more impactful.
Yeah.
And I guess this is sort of when this franchise stops being a whodunit thing, right, too. I mean, obviously, like, the first movie technically is a whodunit, a really bad one.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, nobody saw Mrs. Voorhees until the last act. But this movie, I don't think it's playing on any kind of mystery, is it? Like, it's fairly obvious that this is Jason from the start.
Yeah.
We're name-dropping him too often for it to be someone else.
And also, he's carrying his dead mother's head around and putting them in fridges and things. It's like, it'd be a bit weird if it wasn't him. Yeah.
Honestly, though, for 5 years, it's in pretty good condition.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The fact that she's got any skin left. What's going on there?
I will say, though, it's really fun. So, like, watching these early films, because in the Friday the 13th video game, which is kind of still going on, but not really, the maps are the different maps from, like, 1, 2, 3, and 4. It was really fun watching some of these scenes at this camp to be like, oh, my God, I ran up there and hid in that cabin so many times. But also, every map has this shack in it because the whole thing is, like, there's a part of the game where if you're a female player in the game, you can go in and grab Jason's sweater, and then you have to go to Jason, but then you have to press a certain button right before he's about to hit you, and then you can hypnotize him for, like, 5 seconds. And if Tommy Jarvis is also in the game, then he can kill Jason. It's the hardest fucking thing to do.
Oh my god. Sounds very convoluted and also exciting.
It's very exciting. Honestly, we just kind of did a private game and just did it ourselves, because trying to do this, like, in real time, like, with another player, it's impossible.
Fun. Okay, so Ginny, Paul, and Ted head into town with the other counselors who don't have names and we will never meet, and they're basically going for beer time. Everybody else decides to stay back, more or less so that they can fuck.
Kind of, yes.
So that's definitely Sandra and Jeff's intention, but Vicky is also doing her best to butter up Mark, and then we have Terry taking her extreme crop top to go skinny dipping.
Okay, Terry's like, I'm gonna go for a walk, and I was like, bitch, it is nighttime outside, what the fuck are you gonna do? And then she wants to go skinny dipping in this disgusting ass lake in the middle of the night, like, she had it coming.
Trace loves nature, so
I hate feeling the mud of a lake water, like, on my feet. Like, I'm wearing pool shoes.
I am with you 100%, Trace. That would put me off immediately. I would need some sort of footwear on for that. Yeah,
you
for
divas.
Sure.
Just get in the water.
Oh my god. Well, look what happens when you get in the water.
Nothing. She goes for a swim. Scott steals her clothes, and it's only because they run into a fucking trap that anything bad happens.
Basically, I like the little, like, the kind of foreplay we're getting between Terry and Scott here, and I like that she also threatens to just leave him there and calls him a pervert, because there's nothing I love more than the word pervert.
Nothing.
And he is a pervert. He does deserve to hang there for a bit.
I mean, his character is introduced hitting her in the butt with a slingshot.
Oh yeah, as we get the Fast and the Furious, like, but like a low level butt shot of her. Yes.
Fully zooming up her ass. What is this, a Michael Bay movie?
What do y'all call perverts in the UK? Sex pests, right?
Sex. I mean, we like pervert too, but yes, sex pest. Sex pest is a good is definitely a good one. Yeah.
See, it just sounds so much better with your accent, Mike. When we say it, it's like sex pest.
I mean, honestly, when I say pervert, which Schwarzenegger is? Is it Kindergarten Cop, where he's like, "I'm not the pervert."
I do believe you're right. Yep. So, needless to say, Scott gets hung upside down, and this feels a little Texas Chainsaw Massacre-y to me, but he gets machete throat slit, and
his extended death, it's just a 10-second shot of blood just pouring out of this neck wound.
Okay, because I was gonna say, this feels a bit underwhelming.
Yeah, basically in the original cut, it would have held longer, and we would have seen a lot more blood. A quick spray, but mostly it just, like, runs down his head.
Right. Okay. Mm. Terry comes back after trying to find some help, and she is killed off screen, presumably, because she screams, and then we use that to transition into a mix with the band's audio at the bar that Ginny and Paul and Ted are at.
That actually makes me excuse the fact that this is an off-screen kill.
It's a good transition.
Yeah, I also just like, I mean, like, again, her, like, again, it's the thing, the same with Alice at the shower at the beginning of the movie, where she's staring directly at Jason slash us, the audience, and there is something scary about seeing her just scream, like, her blood-curdling scream right at you.
At us, yeah.
Yeah, and I like that trope of, like, then we immediately smash cut to, like, something loud happening elsewhere, right? It's used a lot in my favorite slasher, Black Christmas. That is, like, used over and over again in Black Christmas, isn't it? Yeah, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the scene where I think if you were a little uncertain about Ginny as a character in terms of, ooh, is she a bad girl? Should we not be rooting for her? The fact that she is so willing to empathize with Jason as a person, right? Like how scary it must have been for him to have seen his mother get killed as a little boy, to have spent all those years living by himself. I think this is really endearing to our final girl.
For sure, yeah. And obviously it's an interesting setup to what we get at the end, right? Which is where she bests Jason using psychology, basically. Like, that's like a superpower, right? It's very cool.
It's also like the most introspective that some of these earlier films are, because like we talk a lot about how like, no one really grieves in slasher films when people die, when their best friends die. So this isn't exactly that, but it's like, like we're getting a moment of pathos from this character in a franchise that doesn't really have a lot of pathos.
Well, and I think it also lends, I think compared to Michael Myers or certainly compared to Freddy Krueger, there's something of a sympathetic side to Jason too, right? Like, I don't know, there's something about him that people kind of like, you know, have warm fuzzy feelings towards Jason sometimes, don't they? I think I don't know, there's something about him that is like, you get where he's coming from a little bit, you know, like given his backstory.
Yeah, it's weird, right? Because we should have a similar relationship to Michael Myers, but because of wild Dr. Loomis constantly telling us that he is evil embodied behind those black eyes, I don't think we look at him in the same way, whereas Jason I've always looked at as a slightly infantilized, like, you know, he's a hurt child who is trying to fight back against all these horny counselors who maybe have it coming.
They really double down on that in the awful Freddy versus Jason, don't they? Where they kind of make Freddy the villain almost, right? And there's all those sequences when like you see Jason reduced to like a little quivering boy and Freddy's like torturing him and stuff, you know.
I think Freddy versus Jason is a really fun watch. I mean, like, it's definitely not a good movie, but like I think it's a real fun time.
Yeah, it's got some good sequences for sure.
Sure. I mean, if you're going to watch one Ronnie Yu slasher film, make it Bride of Chucky. There's a lot of fun to be had in some of the silliness of Freddy versus Jason.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So back at camp, we've got Mark revealing how he lost the ability to walk and why he's in the wheelchair. So he was in a motorcycle accident. And this is very endearing to Vicky, to the point that she wants to fuck him.
Well,
and
his dick, she asked him, like, is it just your leg? So she's like, she basically asked him, does your dick still work?
Yeah,
she is not being subtle, is she, with her, like, come-ons?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. So these are my two favorite characters outside of Jenny. Like, these are my two favorite characters because love watching their romance develop. Uh-huh. And honestly, it is her asking him about his accident and even his dick, where I'm like, again, I love those type of like honest like conversations, and it endears me to these characters so much, to the point where I actually get genuinely upset when poor Vicky dies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, she's a highly sympathetic character. I just think it's really, really important to acknowledge that we've got a disabled character in this film who is treated as a sexually viable candidate. Like, the fact that these two have a romance, you know, we need to raise the question of, hey, can we do it? That's a valid question. But it's not like, I'm fucking you out of sympathy, or you're not as good a candidate as somebody like Scott. This is very much like, we have a genuine connection. Shall we get down to it? And I think that is really fucking progressive for an early 80s movie.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there was a very kind of lazy alternative option where they could have made his character like
sad, pathetic.
Yeah, or like what's his name in part three? Shelley, is it? Is it Shelley? They could have made him the kind of like the joke character almost or something, you know? And it's nice that they didn't do that in this movie. You're right.
Well, and actually, I mean, this would, of course, come 6 years later, but Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors with the wizard kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Although he's not really sexually active as far as I can tell.
and that, to me, is the big difference about Mark. Like, I think it changes the game a little when you have an actor who looks this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it changes the way that we look at a disabled character right. when we look at someone who looks like McBride does. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess I just really appreciate that the film wanted to do something where we've got a disabled character, but that doesn't make them less than. They're not an object of ridicule or mockery. And also they, yeah, can be a sexual person.
I also like that he wins the arm wrestle against Jeff.
Uh-huh.
And then also he basically says, you know, oh, the doctors don't think I'm ever going to walk again, but I disagree. Like, I'm not mm-hmm. going to let this be the end of it. And so, I don't know, like, it gives him like a drive. Like, it's a tiny little character tidbit, but like, it gives him a drive that is just, again, refreshing to see.
Yeah, mm-hmm. these tiniest little tidbits are something that we do not get in later Friday the 13th movies right. as well, you know? So yeah, we've got to take what we can get here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Vicky is spraying her cooch with perfume, which I don't know.
You don't like?
Is that sanitary? Well, no. I'm just thinking about when he's eating her out later. Like, it's just going to taste like chemicals.
Yeah, that don't do that. It's not great. Yeah. Although I do like the fact that she's like, okay, I'm wearing perfectly normal underwear, but I'm going to change into these like shit brown satin yes. panties.
We had a whole long conversation about this on my podcast, about this exact scene of her actually looking really, really hot.
She looks great.
And then
great.
Going, I'm going to go change into something a little more comfortable and putting on this kind of woolly jumper and brown knickers. And we were like, mm-hmm. what's happening here?
Do you like shit, Mark? Because I do. She's like that guy at the Folsom Fair that was covered in shit. That's her kink.
I mean, to be clear, she still looks really, really good.
Incredible.
It's just
yeah.
more the fact that it's like, I don't know, girls, you don't need to look this way to appeal to people just to get fucked. Like,
she would have looked better just walking in completely bottomless.
Oh,
maybe she put those on. Yeah, maybe she put those on so that he would tear them off quicker. You know, just wow. let's just get rid of these.
Ew, what the fuck are those? Take them off.
Take them off.
To be clear, would we like this better if they were any other color?
Well, here's the thing, though. They don't look very fitting. They look kind of baggy on her.
Exactly. Yeah, they're slightly too big and baggy as well, yeah.
I do think this is an 80s thing, though.
Because they're brown, though, it looks like she's kind of taking a dump on herself.
Oh, my God.
Amazing.
Anyway, this all builds to, unfortunately, not even a sex scene. Like, these poor characters don't even get to fuck. Sandra and Jeff, the two idiots, actually get to consummate this relationship. But poor Vicky and Mark, they just get killed. And it's very unceremonious.
And poor Vicky is so traumatized. Like, she's the one that finds the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At least she never finds Mark's body, because that poor guy, his wheelchair is somewhere in the trees.
God,
yeah. I will say, though, the sequence where we follow Jason's knife as he's advancing on Vicky after she sees Sandra mm-hmm. and Jeff's bodies, again, it's not like it's breaking new ground, but I just think it's a really interesting choice in how to frame this death sequence. We don't really see Vicky get killed. We see her get stabbed, and then we kind of cut away from it. But this knife sequence seems really memorable to me.
Well, and I think, again, you could argue it's homaging, again, that opening scene of Halloween, but I also get a lot of Peeping Tom from this.
Yeah.
But I will say, so again, with these extended kill scenes, yeah, we do get a wide shot of Jeff and Sandra with the spear through them, and it's clearly a fucking, like, body mold of Jeff.
Right.
But with Sandra, it's not a gorier scene, but we hold in her reaction as she's looking at her knife wound a lot longer, so it's almost more... Like, it's not gorier,
yeah,
but it's more
there's more
upsetting.
Terror. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think there's a reason why this scene, again, feels very memorable compared to, like, some of the others in the series. And I think, yeah, it's that the visual kind of choices, but also that there is some genuine fear and terror in this scene as well, which, again, so many Friday the 13th kills are like something comes out of nowhere, stab, slash, and cut to the next scene, you know? Whereas this scene has a bit more than that. Yeah.
There's tension. We're actually taking our time and building it up, right? Even when Vicky comes in and she sees the little smatter of blood stains mm-hmm. on the sheets,
yeah,
and then that's when Jason sits up, which again feels very Halloween to me. But you're right, Mike, it does feel like in other films we would have just slashed her and be done with it and move on to the next scene, and here it feels like we're taking a little bit more time.
Well, and this is the first true glimpse of the potato sack on Jason's head. I do even think his reveal, like sitting up in this bed, it's a really good jump scare.
Yeah, I like it.
It's great.
The other thing I like is when we get to see just Vicky's legs getting dragged down the stairs. Mm. Again, you don't need to put this in here because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what happens to the bodies. We always get, you know, a Jason art display at some point in these films where he's like, look what I can do, stack bodies. But I think it's really unnerving to just watch her legs, her bloody legs, get dragged down the stairs.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like, I think Steve Miner clearly is kind of a fan of horror and cinema, right? And you can see that in he references to films like Peeping Tom and Psycho. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously as well in this movie, it's been discussed a lot, but there are overt references / ripoffs to Bay of Blood. Yeah, Twitch of the Death Nerve, the Giallo, the Mario Bava movie, where almost shot for shot, right? The kind of the couple having sex that get like shish kebabbed and the machete in the face as well. Like those are taken completely wholesale from Bay of Blood. Yeah.
So fun. I wonder how many people would have gotten those references in the 80s. Like, again, thinking about how difficult it might have been to get your hands on an Italian import horror.
Yeah.
Well, and they claim that they had never seen A Bay of Blood. So this according to them, this is not an intentional homage to that film. But who cares? Whatever.
Yeah, that would be a very big coincidence if those two were, if that was not an intentional homage. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So Ted, meanwhile, is dead drunk. So Ginny and Paul leave his ass at the bar and head back to camp.
Oh, Ted died in a drunk driving accident. That's what happened there. Yeah. They did not bring him back to the cabin. They left him to find his own way home.
Oh, you don't think he just hooked up with that lady who was sitting next to him in front of those 20 bottles of beer? So we get back and obviously the cabin is in a complete state of disarray because no one has cleaned it up and we've been dragging bodies through it. So Ginny goes upstairs. She discovers the bloody bed, like a lot of blood on this bed.
Yeah.
But no bodies. The bodies have all been moved. And this is when she says, we're not fucking alone. And that is when Paul gets attacked and the chase begins.
I mean, I tweeted this out yesterday, but I was like, I'm blaming myself for this too, but I'm really surprised that when you have these discussions, be it in person or on social media, about best horror movie chase scenes, this doesn't come up more. I mean, I guess you could argue maybe there's a few more breaks in it, so it's not one long chase scene, but I would argue it is.
Yeah, I would say so as well. And it is, I think it's one of the best sections of the movie right here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It helps that we're really only following Ginny. You know, Paul will jump in and out to not be any kind of help at all, except for one moment. But this is Ginny's sequence. And even though we don't know that much about her, we know enough to care whether she lives or dies. She's obviously our final girl. But she's making smart decisions, which immediately endears her to me. And we are moving all over the fucking place. So this isn't she's cowering in a bathroom for 10 minutes as Jason stabs through or something. We're moving around and it's keeping it really visually interesting.
So here's the thing. I don't know if y'all agree with this or not, but like, I think there's something that doesn't feel particularly cinematic about this chase scene. It maybe not quite a documentary feel, but it just feels quote unquote normal, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
it feels real. Like we're there with her. I mean, the first big one, you know, where she goes in the bathroom, she's holding the door and she's trying to like make sure the window's shut. And then we get that, again, amazing fucking jump scare where he crashes through the window.
So good.
But I don't know. Yeah, there's just something that feels like I'm in this with her that makes it scarier.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's not stylized in any way, is it? And that's what I mean about, I think there's something that these original few Friday the 13th movies have. There's a kind of like scritchy, scratchy, almost like found footage looking element to them in a weird way, you know, where it does feel like it's just some madman running around in the woods with a camera, right? And I like that element of this particular sequence, yeah.
It's a little bit more guerrilla filmmaking in a way.
Yeah, right? It feels a little bit more unsafe for that reason, right? There's less gloss.
But you're right, Joey. We're moving. So we're in a cabin here, then we're in the woods, then we're in the car, then we're in the woods again, then we go to another cabin with this pee shit, and then we're going in the woods again, and then we're in the shack. Like, this is, boom, I mean, the last 20 minutes of this movie.
We're just on the move. But also, can we talk about the score in this sequence?
Yes!
Thank you. this is so close to the Psycho score that I couldn't believe it wasn't.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, okay. But it's effective, though.
Oh, it's so fucking good. It also feels like someone reached through the TV screen and cranked the volume on me because it is almost overpowering.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. It's a lot. The score is a lot. I think it does a lot of the heavy lifting, doesn't it? But it really works.
So yeah, Ginny ends up taking cover under the bed. This is when she pees. Jason presumably sees it. He climbs up onto a chair to get her. So when she comes out, he's there. But even though he's not particularly girthy, he doesn't manage to not break the chair. This is when she attacks him with the chainsaw. And I'm not going to lie, I would be curious to know if the people who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 didn't look at this and say, hey, that's a precursor for Stretch.
Yeah, I could see that. I could absolutely see that.
Definitely.
I mean, it's a fleeting moment, right? Like, I actually thought that the chainsaw was going to play a larger role in this the first time I saw it, because who brings out a chainsaw for one scene?
It's true.
But it's nice, though, because we get to see Jason scared. And I think that's also a really good facet to this whole sequence.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, we kind of skipped the car scene, but I do want to say, I love that where he's using a pitchfork. He, like, busts through a door with this pitchfork, by the way.
Yep.
I don't know why he doesn't stab the driver's side of the seat when he's doing this, but whatever. Yeah. But I think there's a really good shot, too, where the pitchfork comes through the roof of this car, but then his hand comes through as he's trying to grab for her, which I really, really like.
Yeah.
Gotta love a scene in a car always, right, as well?
Always.
Yeah.
Even the fact that we try multiple cars, because she tries her car, but of course, we already knew it wasn't going to start. Because
Chekhov's bad engine.
Yeah. Yes. So she has to hop in this yellow car, and... Yeah, it's fun, right? Like, watching Ginny scramble around, and as you mentioned earlier, Trace, we're often seeing Jason either moving towards her or sort of moving through the background. So even when he's not there, he's still such a presence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is a running Jason, too, so he can move.
He can move. So Ginny ends up eventually finding the murder shrine, which includes Mama Voorhees's head, as well as her iconic blue sweater. And this is when we're using our pop psychology that we referenced earlier. So she throws on that sweater and impersonates Mom.
What do we think of this?
I love this sequence. I think it's great. Yeah, I love it. You know, weirdly, going back to what I said earlier about how I watched these films out of order, I watched part three before part two. And as if you remember, but part three begins with this scene. Like, it just, it doesn't even bother with little flashbacks. Like, it just plays out this whole sequence. Yeah. And I remember being very confused by this. I was like, this is a weird way to open a movie. Who's this blonde chick and what's happening here?
What are we doing?
Yeah. But it is. It's such a great scene, I think. Yeah.
And actually, I'm sorry, I just looked at the runtime for part three. Part three is 95 minutes, so a full 10 minutes longer than this movie. And so we don't even need to just redo the scene.
No.
I think it was one of the reasons why I disliked these films a little bit more than their other contemporaries, because it felt like we needed to do this, as though the previous film was so convoluted. And I was always frustrated that the new film couldn't find a better way to inform viewers how it goes.
Or they just think we're dumb and forgot about it from the last year.
Well, possibly that.
Or they're wondering, hey, people are going to walk into this not having seen the last movie, I guess. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that they're caught up and therefore give good word of mouth about the film. Because if they're confused, the word of mouth won't be good.
Sure.
It's weird, though, because, like, not to get into part three, but, like, I just feel like this sequence doesn't really give you any information that you'd need to know going into part three. It's almost like they just thought it was a cool scene that they just wanted to show us again, I think.
Which is correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Out of context, I can't imagine what you would have thought just watching this. Why is the movie starting this way? Yeah. What does this mean?
It's like, who's this final girl? Who's this guy with the sack on his head? Who's this woman that he's pretending to be? And what's she got to do with anything? Like, what's happening?
Yeah.
Where am I right now? Yeah. Have I dissociated? Ooh. Did the edible kick in?
Three's the one with the handstand death, too, right?
Yes, that's the one.
Oh, man. I can't hate a movie with that handstand death, man. I love that death.
Okay, so Ginny kicks into mom mode, where she is basically lambasting her son, telling him to kneel. She's buying herself time because she has, of course, managed to get her hands on this machete. Unfortunately, she moves a little to one side and he catches the real head in his vision.
So I was like Jada Pinkett Smith in Scream 2, where I'm like, move.
Yeah.
Did you put on your maroon sweater just because you were like, ooh?
Of course. Looks like you're just in time. Looks like she's about to get it.
Indeed, yes. So Jenny nearly bites it here. This is when Paul does the only useful thing he does in this entire fucking movie. So he busts in, manages to distract Jason briefly, and he buys Jenny enough time so that we can shift into ultra slow-mo as we slice Jason in the neck.
And this is redoing the exact same kind of style of Mrs. Voorhees getting decapitated in that first movie. But again, the score, when it's like, do, it's so effective.
It's so operatic, right?
Yeah.
It is. It's big. They're going big, right? And I love it. And I love the slow-mo. It's great.
I mean, do y'all think she was aiming for his head and missed? Because I wouldn't have assumed this would have killed him.
No. It definitely looks like it would have drawn blood, but I feel like maybe he could have put a quick hand on it and continued the chase, which I guess ironically he does.
Yeah.
So they end up pulling the bag off of Jason's head, but I love that they resist the inclination to show us what he looks like yet. It does then tease us that he will come back later, because you're not going to pull a bag off of a creature's head and then not show us.
Wouldn't it have been funny if, like, Paul vomited?
And this is another thing, I suppose, that really differentiates it from Halloween and Michael Myers, right, is that they love in every movie to take off the mask and show the face, you know, and they really love that, don't they? Yeah.
I feel like because it does feel like a whodunit in that moment, as though here's your killer, you're finally getting to see them, except that in these cases, it's just, oh, here's someone with a facial deformity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what Jason, I think part 7 is the one that has the best maskless Jason for me, because that's also the one where he has the spine, like that's exposed.
Yes,
but I guess part 4 is okay too.
Part 4 is pretty good. I think part 8 is the worst, right? With the Manhattan, it's pretty bad. Oh, I think
do they unmask him in the sewers?
Yes, and his face is all kind of melting. It's not great.
Yeah. And then he becomes a child because that's what chemicals do.
Sure. See, at least in this film we're kind of using proper psychology. I mean, proper in quotation marks, but
yeah, no, I mean, but again, as we have said, like it shows Ginny's resourcefulness, and even though it's kind of dumb, like it makes for a good climax.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that we've got the action we're coming to expect, or that we're looking for in these movies, but also we're showing her intellect, right? Like her ability to reason and use logic to get herself out of this. Like, I like that we get both a bit of downtime, but also some bloodletting.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
So Jenny and Paul end up making their way back to the main cottage because, of course, they believe that the danger is over. Fools. And, well, sort of. Paul knows enough to give Jenny the pitchfork, so she's just there, braced, waiting for something to burst through this door as he stands next to it. I love that he basically uses her as bait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stand by this window real quick.
So this is, of course, the Muffin reveal. It's the revelation. The dog we saw earlier is not Muffin. Muffin is still alive. Oh, super cute. And then we get the best fucking jump scare in the entire film.
I think what makes this work just as well as the jump scare from the first movie is every time I watch it, I can never remember when the jump scare happens.
Yes. Nope. Yeah, it really takes it, like with this movie and the first one, right? It really takes its time. It really sits in that moment before it gives you the jump. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't really get to see what happens because we're back into a bit of slow-mo, but we do get to see what Jason looks like without the mask on. And it's brief but effective. And then Jenny gets dragged out and we once again fade to white and we pick back up the next morning as she's being loaded off into the ambulance, demanding to know where Paul is. And we get a quick little zoom in on Mama Voorhees's severed head. That's the end of the movie.
So, again, Mandela effect. I do have a distinct memory of watching this on TV and those heads' eyes open up.
I was sure the eyes were going to open as well. Dude. Yeah.
Okay. So, That was how the film was supposed to end, but then Steve Miner removed the scene out of the final cut because he decided that it would make the film's conclusion too silly. Yeah. And apparently this footage of this alternate ending has never been released, but you know how, like, with Halloween 2, there's, like, the TV edit of it? I really wonder if somehow, somewhere, some way, like...
It got out.
Yes, because I have such a distinct memory of this head's eyes opening up. But again, maybe it's the Mandela effect.
Yeah, I am exactly the same, Trace. Like, I was waiting for those eyes to open, even on today's rewatch. And I've seen this film about 80 times at this point. And I was like, what? Yeah.
Well, do you think it's just because we know so much about the production of these films? Because we've got such an in-depth documentary. We've heard people talk and theorize about them for decades at this point. Like, even though... Full confession, Friday is not my favorite slasher series. That would still be A Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm. It just feels like we know so much about the big three in the 80s that, you know, there's wild speculation. There's all these different cuts. And it just feels like we've ingrained certain pieces like trivia and alternate cuts to the point that we think they're real.
Yeah. I think it could be that for sure. Yeah.
But nevertheless, listeners, let us know. Do you also have a distinct memory of these eyes opening up on one of your TV viewings?
It's just we're pushing in on them for so long, you think something's going to happen.
Which I almost like because it feels restrained, right? And so when we do just kind of go to black, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah,
the movie's done. You're safe now.
Yeah, you're bracing yourself for something that doesn't come. And so I almost, which is the exact opposite of what these movies do.
Exactly that. It's a weirdly low-key ending, actually, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because normally we'd go for a final scare. I actually really like the fact that it is a bit restrained.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
But that's Friday the 13th Part 2.
Well, I mean, so, Mike, as the guest of honor, final thoughts on this film?
I think it's great. Like, I actually think in some ways this is like the quintessential Friday the 13th movie. It's like if I wanted to show somebody in a nutshell what is Friday the 13th, I think I would maybe show them this movie. Like, it kind of ticks all of the beats, doesn't it? Apart from the fact that it doesn't feature the hockey mask.
Right.
Right.
Everything else feels like it gives you exactly what you'd imagine of a kind of low-budget, early 80s Friday the 13th slasher movie, and it's done well. I think it is like, top three Friday the 13th for me, for sure. Like, yeah, I think it's a really, really strong entry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So wait, what are the other two then, Mike?
I'm just thinking about that now in my head. I think it would be...
like, oh shit, I shouldn't have said it out loud.
I think it would be parts one and part four. I think it's... Yeah, I think one, two, and four are probably my three favorites. Like I said, I'm a really big fan of the early years of the Friday the 13th movies, particularly, I think. And then six would be close behind that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so out of the latter entry, six is your best of those.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Not a big fan of 7. I think it's a really cool idea that it's a bit of a wasted opportunity. And then, again, part 8, a really fun idea that isn't as executed as well as you want it to be, I think, you know?
My thing with 8, and, like, that's second bottom of the franchise for me. I even have it below Jason Goes to Hell, because at least Jason Goes to Hell is, like, just wacky.
Yeah. Jason Goes to Hell is amazing, so fuck you very much.
Yeah. Oh, Jason Goes to Hell is a movie. So, again, 2 and 6 alternate between my number 1 and 2 spots a lot, but then it's Final Chapter. Then I do have part 3, but we haven't mentioned the remake at all. I actually really like the remake of this film, because I do think it is a loving ode to these first 4 films.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you know what? I should give it another watch. I've only seen it once in the theater when it first came out, whenever that was, 2009. And I hated it at the time. I thought it was really boring. But I should give it another go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we marathoned these with some of our friends. And one of our friends, he was like, fuck that remake. He hadn't seen it since the theaters in 2009. He was like, all those characters are horrible. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I mean... That's what we do in 2000s horror, but sure.
Yeah, exactly.
but of course, you know, so we finish our marathon with the remake, and by the end of it, he was like, shit, that was a lot more fun than I remembered it being.
Okay. Here's the thing. I think it had been so long since we had gotten a new one, it wasn't giving us exactly what we expected, and that opening is
great. Kind
of confronting, right? Mm-hmm. So you get out of it, and I think you've got to reconcile with the fact that it's not what you expected, but I will say it plays much better on a rewatch.
Yeah, okay. I agree. So let us know, Mike.
Yeah, maybe I should. Maybe I should. Yeah, I lump it in with The Nightmare on Elm Street 2010, and I'm just...
Oh, God,
I'm
no.
I'm not a fan of these movies.
That movie is uninspired and boring and made by people who hate the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise.
Right,
except for
exactly.
those poor actors, that fantastic cast that are stranded in a terrible movie.
Oh, it's
but
just
Friday the
13th, terrible.
At least, I think Marcus Nispel, like that and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like I think those are great remakes. But yeah, I think you can feel the love for the franchise in that remake, even though I will say I do think the weakest part of it is the kills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's such a shame that, I mean, like, we know, speaking of Steve Miner, that's the way I feel about Halloween H2O. I kind of feel like it's a great movie, just not a very good horror or slasher movie.
Yes. I would agree. But I think the Laurie arc and all of her PTSD is better
so
and like is better than anything in that new trilogy we got.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think like, and I know this is a whole other conversation, but I think like, I think H2O and 2018, H4O, are like, they're kind of polar opposites in what their strengths are, I think, because like 100%. H2O is a great Laurie Strode film, not a very good horror film. I think David Gordon Green made a quite fun slasher film, but it's a really bad Laurie Strode film, I think.
Agreed.
2018, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But all right, Joe, any final thoughts from you on this?
I'll just say this is such a pleasant surprise for me, having again not seen this in quite some time. This movie was just really fun and well done. I'd forgotten how good Miner directs this, and that was a joy. That score is loud as fuck, and so it's doing so, so much in this movie. And yeah, you know, Ginny, classic, all-timer.
A fucking man.
Yeah.
Well, before we announce what we're covering next week, Mike, first, thank you so much for coming on to discuss this at this spookiest of seasons, but let everyone know, where can they find you and your podcast on social media?
Oh, thank you so much. It's been so much fun. So I do the Evolution of Horror podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Twitter, X, whatever, Instagram, all the Blue Sky Threads, all the fucking socials. You can find me anywhere. We're doing a series on home invasion movies at the moment, which you guys have both featured on, which has been really fun. But we are also dropping a little bonus Friday the 13th episode as well this month. Because it's October, it's Friday the 13th. We got our patrons to decide which two Friday the 13th movies they wanted to hear discussed. And they voted for part two and part four. So there you go. So we've covered that also over on Evolution of Horror. But yeah, you can find that wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at HorrorQueers, or shoot us an email at HorrorQueers@gmail.com. Find us on Letterboxd to keep track of all the films we've covered. Go to our YouTube channel to check out our interviews with various horror filmmakers, and tune in once a month to hear us talk about our most anticipated horror films for that month. If you want to connect with other listeners, please join our Facebook group. If you have a moment, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Hey, it's October. This is a great time to do that. Please go leave us a 5-star review.
Sure.
If you want even more content, please support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/horrorqueers. If you subscribe today, you will get about 265 hours of Patreon content, including this month's new episodes on It Lives Inside, No One Will Save You, Totally Killer, Saw 10, Exorcist Believer, and our audio commentary for the month on John Carpenter's original Halloween.
Yeah.
But Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Next week is a first-time watch for me. What are we covering?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, we're going to gay it up to the nth degree for better and worse.
Yeah.
We're going to check out the 25th anniversary of Apt Pupil.
Yes. Stephen King adaptation directed by noted Predator Bryan Singer. So, again, proceed at your own risk, I guess, is maybe the phrase I want to use.
Yeah, thankfully we've got some Ian McKellen to balance it out. But, you know, also Nazism.
Yes. I'm so excited.
Yay!
Yay, Nazis! Anyway, but yes, until next week, everyone, we can cross out Friday the 13th, Part 2.
Indeed. And cross out Horror Queers.